WNYC Studios is brought to you by ZBiotics. Seize the day after a night of drinks with ZBiotics pre-alcohol probiotic drink. ZBiotics was invented by PhD scientists to break down the byproduct of alcohol, which is most responsible for making you feel crummy the next day. Drink ZBiotics before your first drink, drink responsibly, and you'll wake up refreshed and ready to take on the day. Try it for yourself at ZBiotics.com/WNYC and get 15% off your first order when you use WNYC at checkout. That's ZBiotics.com/WNYC and use the code WNYC at checkout for 15% off. WNYC Studios is supported by Dana-Farber Cancer Institute. Protein degradation can target and destroy cancer-causing proteins right inside the cell. It's how Dana-Farber is working to treat previously untreatable cancers. Learn more at DanaFarber.org/everywhere.
Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
It's the Brian Lehrer Show on WNYC. Good morning again, everyone. New York Times reported over the weekend that two guidance counselors and a sheriff's deputy at Marjory Stoneman Douglas High School, where, of course, former student Nicholas Cruz killed 17 people on Valentine's Day, that those guidance counselors and a sheriff's deputy considered trying to forcibly commit Cruz in 2016. Their decision came after a concerned student reported that Cruz had told them that he had a gun, told him, the other student, that he had a gun at home and was thinking of using it, though at that time he apparently only owned a pellet gun, according to the Times, in addition to making threats to himself and others, cutting his arms and claiming to have drunk gasoline with suicidal intentions. Now, such a commitment to a psychiatric hospital, made possible under the authority of a Florida state law called the Baker Act, would have rendered him unable to pass the background check required to buy an AR-15 5 months later, the gun he purchased legally and used in the mass shooting. But psychologists concluded that the Baker Act would not justify committing Cruz at that time because he had denied any intent to hurt himself or others. School officials ultimately changed their minds and did not initiate the Baker Act. And that, of course, leads to an important facet of the new discussion about guns in America. Last month, Florida Governor Rick Scott signed a law that would give police more power under the Baker Act to confiscate the guns of people deemed to be a threat, keep the mentally ill, deemed mentally ill beyond a certain point, from obtaining guns, and withhold those guns for up to a year. Only five states currently have such laws. They are Connecticut, Indiana, California, Oregon, and Washington, alternately called gun violence restraining orders, extreme risk protection orders, and informally red flag laws. But since Parkland, many states are considering such legislation anew. New York's version of such a bill has been approved in the Assembly by large margins and now awaits a decision in the Republican-controlled state Senate. So let's talk about these so-called red flag laws, how they work, and the public safety versus constitutional rights conflict inherent to them. We are joined by Alex Yablon, reporter covering guns for The Trace, which is a news organization which specifically follows America's gun violence crisis. Alex, thanks so much for coming into our studio.
Thanks for having me.
And let me just start with a tweet that we got from a listener who is concerned about the term red flag laws because they think it stigmatizes people who are mentally ill. Is this a controversial label?
It is. I've actually gotten some pushback on it from some academics who have been looking into this. They prefer the actual legal terms like gun violence restraining order or extreme risk protection order. Some experts are concerned about the term red flag law.
So how mentally ill does one have to be to actually have guns that you legally own confiscated from you by the state? Pick any one of these six states that has such a law.
So crucially, mental illness is not the criteria. It's about threats. Someone can make a threat without having a diagnosable mental illness, and someone can have a diagnosable mental illness without posing a threat or being involuntarily committed to psychiatric care, which is really the standard that's used by the background check system to stop someone from getting a gun. So, you know, there's an example that I did a little bit of reporting on in Connecticut of someone, of a man who threatened to come and shoot up his place of business because of a dispute with his boss. He was subject to one of these orders. There was no indication that he was mentally ill at all, but he had a lot of guns. He's made a specific threat after a dispute to come back and use a specific gun. And so that was the pretext.
So do we confuse? Did I just inadvertently confuse the issue by even mentioning mental health in the same breath?
It's an easy thing to conflate. I think a lot of mental health professionals and people who work on gun violence are wary, though, of conflating the two. There's a lot of evidence that people who are mentally ill are not really a threat to the general populace. They're more likely to be victims of gun violence than others. I don't think many people would argue it's a great idea for people with severe mental illness to get guns. But the bigger issue is violent behavior and making threats, which is something that can occur in people with or without mental illness.
So under these laws, who can petition to have guns confiscated from someone?
It depends on the state. In California, it can be a member of a family, of a gun owner, or law enforcement. In other states like Indiana, it's only a member of law enforcement. And I believe in the law that was just passed in Florida, it's only law enforcement. But in California, they're actually trying to expand that. There's a bill that's been proposed there that would allow school administrators, mental health professionals, and others, roommates, for instance, who aren't currently allowed to petition under the law to ask for guns to be confiscated.
So President Trump caused a little bit of a stir last month by suggesting after Parkland that police take guns first if they deem someone a threat and go through due process second. Of course, he backed off on that and, you know, has fallen back in line with the NRA positions. But what was less widely circulated was that he said this in reply to Mike Pence's description of the California law, which Trump, because of its preservation of due process, apparently thought was not extreme enough. So what kind of due process does exist in these laws before the state can confiscate somebody's guns?
A good way to think about it is to compare it to like an ex parte restraining order or a search warrant. You know, those are legal orders that are approved by a judge, but where the person who's the subject of the order is not present at the hearing. So, yeah, you have more due process rights if before an order can be enacted, you get to plead your case. But we already have lots of very common law enforcement tools where there is, you know, the step that's taken where a judge has to approve it, but, you know, the person in question, you know, a gun owner in the case of an extreme risk protection order or, say, an abusive spouse in the case of a restraining order are not present when the decision is made to enact that order.
So they're not present, so they can't defend themselves.
Not at first, but they generally get a chance, depending on the state, 2 weeks or 3 weeks later to have a hearing where they can say, you know, this order was issued in error, or I'm going to seek counseling, or, I don't pose a threat anymore, and get the guns back.
So they can appeal the order.
Yes. In fact.
So if expert opinion is not necessary for seizure of the weapons, is there a concern that people known to have non-dangerous but perhaps commonly misunderstood mental illnesses could be unfairly affected by these laws if they own guns?
It's not something that I've seen happen in states that have these orders, you know, like California, for instance, they're even where these orders are in place, they're not applied that often. In fact, Indiana's attorney general had to remind law enforcement that this law exists there. But it is a concern, and that's why a judge always has to say whether or not the order is going to be issued. You know, someone who, say, suffers from depression or anxiety, a judge would presumably not have their gun seized. Now, if that person said, I'm going to shoot myself, that would be a different story.
In fact, Indiana is the answer to the which one does not belong question on the list of states that have these red flag laws. The most liberal states in America include Connecticut, California, Oregon, and Washington. And Indiana, huh? Mike Pence's state. What's that even doing on the list, giving the state more power to take away people's guns?
Yeah, so it was passed, I believe in 2005 or 2006, which was definitely a different political moment. You know, it was before Sandy Hook. The gun conversation was not quite so partisan, and I think it passed with a lot less public scrutiny. So, you know, up until very recently, if a state tried to pass one of these laws, it would be a very partisan affair. But that may be changing in the last few weeks.
Listeners, you have a question or a comment or even an experience with a so-called red flag law, 212-433-WNYC, technically called gun violence restraining orders or extreme risk protection orders, allowing states to confiscate guns from people who are considered a threat of using them, 212-433-9692. 212-433-9692. And Tim in Brooklyn, you're on WNYC. Hello.
Hi. I'm a gun owner. I strongly support red flag laws. California, interestingly, you know, you were talking about restraining orders. In California, a standard restraining order, someone is actually allowed to come and contest it on the first day. I believe that should be in place for red flag orders. But I also think that these red flags laws should be as easy to enact as a simple restraining order. Now, as a gun owner, I had a moment, 8 years ago or so, where I got so angry at an ex-lover over the phone and just yelled things that were incredibly unkind, not threatening, and I didn't feel threatening, but I lost control of my emotions. And one of the first things that I did, having noticed that this had happened, was I brought my guns to a friend's house and told him not to give them back to me for 30 days because I thought that was the responsible thing to do. And I don't feel like it's in any way some sort of constitutional violation to be able to impose this on anyone. And I'll just leave that as a comment.
Right. Tim, thank you so much. And that's great that you had that much self-awareness in that situation. Hardly, you know, not everybody does, probably hardly anybody does, and took that step to voluntarily give up your gun for 30 days. Now, he identified himself as a gun owner who strongly supports red flag laws. Alex, what's the NRA position?
They've actually reversed themselves. Last week, Chris Cox, who's the top NRA lobbyist and one of the more prominent public officials at the NRA, and said in a video that the group would endorse a federal bill that would give grants to states that enact their own extreme risk protection orders, which
give grants to states, in other words, actually incentivize states with federal money to pass laws like this?
Right, exactly. Now, this is a really, really big reversal. They've actually opposed every single effort in the states to pass one of these laws. They've called them draconian, open to abuse. And now they're saying they want to incentivize more of them. So there is an emerging bipartisan consensus that these laws don't trample over due process rights or civil rights, which, frankly, I didn't see coming before the NRA released that video.
So do you think that this is a genuine impact of the Parkland shooting, that at least this kind of change in NRA policy, which is going to enable a change in federal policy and then state policies around the country, if it actually gets that far. Is this a real change, or is this the NRA sort of posturing with the least that they can do to stave off the outrage, and then it's all going to get swept under the rug and these laws aren't actually going to get passed?
It could be a little bit of both. It is striking, though. These laws are not that new. You know, Connecticut has had its law since 1999. Indiana has had its law since 2005 or 6. But we didn't have this conversation after the Orlando shooting at the Pulse nightclub, which was committed by someone who had a history of making threats against coworkers and spousal abuse, which are exactly the kinds of things that you would cite in this kind of order. And in that case, you didn't have the same public demand for the passage of these laws. I was writing about them at the time, but they weren't as big of an issue, and the NRA certainly didn't endorse them then.
Teresa in Morris County, you're on WNYC. Hi, Teresa.
Hi, Brian. I'm just a mom with two kids in public school in New Jersey, and I found out here in New Jersey on Thursday, our state legislature is actually considering one of these extreme risk protection order bills. And I'm taking time out of my life to drive an hour and a half to just say that this is important to pass this.
Teresa, thank you very much. And thanks for informing everybody that this is now on the docket in the New Jersey state legislature. An AP survey, in fact, shows that even after this NRA apparent reversal of position, that even on the state level, never mind Congress, where the House is so conservative, the uphill battle may be steeper than some would expect after Parkland. According to the survey, there is still deep partisanship on this issue. 80% of bills proposed by state legislatures to expand gun rights are done so by Republicans, that's to expand gun rights, while 90% meant to limit gun rights are proposed by Democrats. So do you think in general, with respect to these laws or anything else, that there's undue optimism at this point on the gun control side?
I think it's a little bit like trying to turn around a battleship. You know, the NRA and the Republican Party have been so gung-ho about expanding access to guns and the ability to carry guns in public for decades that a sudden reversal like this is not going to happen overnight. But I do think, you know, you saw openness to this, these kinds of orders from folks like Marco Rubio and Lindsey Graham, you know, who have been pretty close allies of the NRA for decades. The bigger question, I agree, will be in the states where the NRA has exerted a very, very strong hold on Republican legislatures, and they have been pretty willing to play hardball in those local races.
I think we have another story kind of like Tim's. From Bill in Mineola. Bill, you're on WNYC. Hi.
Yes, good morning. I spoke to your screener. I had a dispute with a sibling. It started to escalate to an argument, and I placed a 911 call. The operator asked if there were any firearms in the house. I volunteered the information. I said yes. I owned a brand new, never fired shotgun. I gave it to the police. I did receive a receipt. I've never been arrested. There were never prior or future 911 calls to the residence. Now, I've been dealing with some inspector in the local precinct who flatly refuses to return the firearm. I told them, listen to the 911 call. I placed the call. I gave you everything you asked for. I complied. You refused to return my gun. And it just keeps going on. I went to the local DA's office to complain about this and was told by one of their attorneys, oh, maybe there are mental health issues. I said, oh, so now you're a doctor. Bottom line, I've never had mental health issues, and again, never been arrested. They keep and refuse to return my firearm.
What recourse, if you happen to know Alex, and Alex is a journalist, not a gun rights attorney, but do you happen to know what recourse he has?
I don't really. I know that in cases like this, the police have an enormous amount of latitude and discretion over what they do with things seized in situations like this. I would say that it seems to me that an extreme risk protection order would actually provide a way for the caller to get his gun back. You know, if the police had filed an order when they responded to that 911 call, then the caller could show up, you know, 2 weeks or 3 weeks later at the hearing and say, you know, lay out everything he just described. He called 911 in the first place. He's never had any kind of history of mental illness. There haven't been any subsequent 911 calls. But I'm not really sure what he does in the absence of a hearing like that.
David in West Orange, you're on WNYC. Hi, David.
Hi, thanks for taking the call. I'm a psychologist, and occasionally in my work I've been asked to assess whether someone would be considered dangerous or not, both a child or an adult. And my point is, it's just incredibly difficult to make those determinations. We really don't know much about predicting behavior, and the only thing you can go on really is past behavior. So the idea that you can pass a law and that'll solve the problem is very simplistic. These are very difficult decisions. I was involved in a case in a small town in New Jersey where I worked, where a sixth grader was bringing bullets and a broken gun and so on to school to show off. And then he brought a list of kids he was going to kill. And what finally happened was I did an assessment. We found out that he was already in psychiatric treatment. He was already on medication. But we also found out that the father had a number of guns at home. And the police on their own went to his house and took the guns. This was 10 years ago, so it was before any of this. Anyway, they went to the house and took the guns, and that guy was obviously very, very angry, but that was the end of it. The kid he stayed in treatment. I guess hopefully the treatment was adjusted because he didn't do anything like that ever again, but it's just very, very complicated to make these things happen. And in Parkland, the Florida shooting, obviously the police and the educators were not communicating at all, because the police knew Nicholas Cruz's family very well. They'd been to the house many times. It's just bizarre that nothing more was done. Anyway, that's all I have to say.
David, let me just ask you, as a psychologist, how afraid are you of stigmatization of people with whatever kind of mental health issues as violence risks, when it's so easy to conflate the issue of somebody being a threat and therefore the state taking away their otherwise legally owned weapons, and the actual contribution of mental illness to that threat in a small number of cases?
Well, I am very worried about that. Most mentally ill people are not the least bit dangerous. By an overwhelming majority, they're not dangerous. So these cases are rare. And somehow any new law has to take account of that, because it's obviously... I don't see the point of people owning guns in the first place, unless they're living in the woods in Alaska or something, but it's having a mental illness. That's not grounds for anything. I was in a case recently where I made a comment in my report that a woman was depressed, and her husband's lawyers grabbed that and said, look, she's mentally ill, she's dangerous, she shouldn't be with her children. So these kind of things can be misinterpreted very, very easily in a legal process.
David, thank you for that context, and thank you for your call. And we thank Alex Yablon, reporter covering guns for The Trace, which, if you don't know The Trace, it's a news organization totally dedicated to following issues pertaining to America's gun violence crisis. Alex, thank you so much.
It was a pleasure to be here.